I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Madam Speaker, Madam Vice President, no president has ever said those words from this podium. No president has ever said those words. And it's about time.
That was President Biden last night before a joint session of Congress touting his accomplishments during his first 99 days in office. The normally packed chamber held just 200 people because of COVID protocols. Biden is going big, targeting trillions of dollars on programs to lift the middle and working class, hit hard by the pandemic, and even before that, struggling to make ends meet. Last night, he unveiled the American Families Plan, price tag $1.8 trillion, which includes free universal pre-K, paid family leave, and 2 years of free community college. The president, who is still calling for bipartisanship, has a tough road ahead, convincing the GOP to sign on to his big government agenda. We begin our conversation with Megan Casella, and she's a reporter for Politico. Megan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I just wanted to mark the moment in that it was historic. You had two women behind the president of the United States, two very powerful women, and also the unusual nature of last night. So many empty seats, obviously, because of the COVID pandemic, a kind of a stripped down State of the Union. What were we watching last night?
Absolutely. I think, as you just said, I mean, just the imagery last night really set this speech apart from so many previous ones. You know, a lot of the tradition was still there, but as you mentioned, the two women behind him, very sparsely populated chamber, everyone that was there was in masks. It was a real reminder that for all the progress of the last 100 days, which was what the president was talking about, we were still very much in the middle of a crisis, in the middle of a pandemic as a country. And then, you know, we heard him talk about everything he's done so far. And as you just mentioned as well, his very ambitious plans for where we go from here that involves trillions of dollars in spending. And I'm sure we'll get more into that.
We certainly will. But let me just sit and pause on that moment. I think he at this point wants to spend something like $4 to $5 trillion. What's the math, Megan?
It is around $4 to $5 trillion. It's closer to four, but right around there. That's at least what the White House has laid out so far. We're already hearing some talk of, will they need more to actually accomplish the goals that they've laid out? More money, more spending. I mean, they have also laid out a slate of steps to pay for much of that spending. But again, you know, $4 trillion is still a truly massive, unprecedented level of investment in this country. And it comes on top of a year in which Congress already passed around $5 trillion in coronavirus relief money. So it truly is a huge sum of money that we're talking about.
You start adding up trillions of dollars and you're talking about real money, right, Megan?
Yes, exactly.
And in terms of paying for it, I mean, he seems to be saying if you are a wealthy person in this country or if you are a wealthy corporation, we're going to turn to you to foot the bill.
Absolutely. They say that between these tax hikes on the wealthiest families, they say nothing will affect anyone making less than $400,000 per year. But with tax hikes on the wealthiest families and on corporations, that they can pay for both of these plans they've laid out in the last month or so, that $4 trillion. Over 15 years. So while the money would be spent over 10 years in these plans, they would raise it back within 15 years and then could even cut the deficit after that.
Has anyone checked their math on that?
There's a lot of talk, of course. I mean, the biggest question right now is just that the tax hikes actually look to be one of the least popular parts of the plan. Even among Democrats, some Democrats say they're not comfortable with raising their taxes as much as the president has proposed. So of course, if they have to lower the levels that Biden wants to see, that won't raise nearly as much money. And then, of course, you're looking at deficit spending there, even if it did, as it's currently laid out, raise what they said it would raise.
I shorthanded what's in the American Families Plan, but let me play a clip from President Biden. He unveiled this last night, and let's hear how he describes what's in this plan and why he is promoting it.
12 years is no longer enough today to compete with the rest of the world in the 21st century. That's why my American Families Plan guarantees 4 additional years of public education for every person in America, starting as early as we can. The great universities in this country have conducted studies of the last 10 years. It shows that adding 2 years of universal high-quality preschool for every 3-year-old and 4-year-old, no matter what background they come from, puts them in the position to be able to compete all the way through 12 years and increases exponentially their prospect of graduating and going on beyond graduation.
Megan, this is a big, bold plan. Can you kind of flesh it out for us, what the philosophy, the thinking is behind the American Families Plan?
Absolutely. It really would, if passed the way it's laid out now, really broadly transform and expand the role that government plays in public life. And the idea is that by investing directly in families through tax credits, by making their lives easier, by investing in childcare and making it more accessible, by sort of easing their burden by covering childcare, by covering preschool, by allowing people to get 4 extra years of education, both through 2 years of universal pre-kindergarten, 2 years of free community college, so 2 years on each end, that we really would make a healthier, a more productive workforce and be able to compete with other countries by making sure that, you know, it grows the economy, for example, if we have more people who are working. So the idea being that it's a really broad, a really bold investment now that would pay off in the long term.
Is it too soon to say if this is popular or not? I mean, I'm imagining a family raising children that this would look like something very attractive that would make their lives easier.
Absolutely. It does seem broadly popular right now. I don't think there's been quite as much polling yet on the specifics of the Families Plan as there have been of the Jobs Plan, the infrastructure plan, but there has been some, and it looks like it is broadly popular. And actually, interestingly, when you say to people, do you like this plan? It gets pretty good marks. And then when you say, would you like this plan if it were paid for by tax hikes on the wealthy and corporations, the marks actually increase. People tend to like the plan even more when they hear the plan to pay for it, which is an interesting development and I think will really help the White House as it tries to sell this plan.
It also includes paid family leave, medical leave, up to 12 weeks, which is very European sounding.
It certainly is. It certainly is. It would be the first nationwide paid family and medical leave program. Of course, there's a long way to go here. That's something that we don't know if this will be able to pass through Congress. If Democrats use the maneuver known as reconciliation to move it on their own, they may not be able to require employers provide something like paid family and medical leave. So it's one of the big questions there. But just the proposal coming from the White House is bold on its own.
I mean, it seems that President Biden has been listening to the progressives in his party, whether it's Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or others. Would you say that they've had his ear?
Absolutely. I think it's really striking to think about just the characterization of Biden throughout his career that really was magnified during the primary of being the moderate candidate who had always been really middle of the road, wasn't going to do anything too drastic. And then to look at the specifics of these plans, you really see a lot of Elizabeth Warren reflected here. We know she has a relationship with the White House. We see a lot of Bernie Sanders reflected here. And what's interesting, too, is that public polls, again, show that people after 100 days feel that President Obama was more liberal than President Biden has been, even though President Biden's proposals, if you look at the specifics here, are really a much more dramatic step towards expanding the government than anything we've seen in recent history.
Well, of course, he was Obama's vice president. I'm assuming they took a page from the stimulus plan of, gosh, it seems like almost generations ago, but at the very beginning of the Obama administration and deciding to go bigger than that.
Absolutely. And that's a theme that we've actually heard about repeatedly now, that many, many Obama administration officials are openly saying we passed about an $800 billion stimulus in 2009 and it wasn't big enough. And then they suffered for years from these criticisms that the economic recovery was much too slow. It left people behind. It took almost 10 years for us to recover the jobs lost during the Great Recession. The Biden administration came in. Many of them were part of the Obama administration that had passed that $800 billion stimulus. And they said, we're not going to do that again. They said, we're going to go big. We're going to address all of these litany of problems that, one, have been, as you just mentioned, growing in progressive circles, such as childcare and paid family leave, but that also were very much highlighted during the COVID pandemic as issues that were holding back workers, that were clearly going to be a hindrance towards economic recovery, and they're trying to address them all.
He is going big. I mean, there's no question about it. And he is saying government can be a solution to, maybe the solution to some of our big problems. That could be a big gamble for him and for his party.
It could. And interestingly, it's a real shift from what we've seen for the past several decades, really since President Reagan, where government was shrinking. It was ridiculed, really. Everyone talks about, you know, that I'm from the government and I'm here to help, and how no one believed that. But it really does seem like that public opinion has completely shifted on this. NBC News did a poll last week where 55% of Americans, including some Republicans and a lot of independents and most Democrats, but 55% overall said they wanted to see the government do more to provide services and to meet people's needs. It's unclear still at this point, since we're still in it, what exactly has caused that shift. I think the pandemic likely had much to do with it. I think President Trump and his administration had much to do with that. But it's much higher than it was during the Obama years. And that's the backdrop against which Biden is really unveiling all of these proposals. And it's why the White House feels so emboldened to keep pushing and to keep proposing more investment.
What do you think is going to happen when this stuff gets to the U.S. Senate, where, of course, it's 50-50?
Of course, there's going to have to be some changes. I think many of the more ambitious proposals will likely have to be scaled back, at least some. Interestingly, though, I think we may see others become even more ambitious. The child tax credit, for example, which provides direct relief to families, and it's been forecast that it would cut child poverty in half. It's a very, very popular proposal here. Many Democrats and even some Republicans have shown openness to wanting to see that become permanent. Biden actually only proposed extending it through 2025 because it's so expensive, is the thinking there. And so some senators are already saying, and some members of the House as well, that, you know, we need to make that part permanent. So just as other things might fall by the wayside, we may see some aspects even get punched up a little bit more. So we'll have to see where it all lands.
And we're almost out of time here, but do you see the possibility of breaking it into component parts and working on these individual pieces rather than these giant packages?
We could, but I do think that they're wary of losing public support if they move too slowly or break it into too many pieces. My guess would be that it's either two packages or one if they end up rolling it all together to see. But we just don't know yet. The legislative strategy is actually a little bit unclear, but I think that'll start to develop really soon.
So what's the timeline? I mean, clearly we've got a president in a big hurry, but what's the timeline when it hits Congress?
I think it could be months. We all know that Congress isn't known for its very quick work, and I think it'll be months between what the House comes up with, what the Senate wants to see. Given those very, very thin majorities, any one senator, any group of three House Democrats or Republicans, the Democrats really have the power here, could hold the bill hostage and threaten to torpedo it. So it's going to take a long time to really balance out what every different party wants.
Well, Megan Casella, thank you for getting our conversation started. And she's a reporter for Politico. And we were talking about the American Families Plan. It was unveiled last night by President Biden. We're going to take a very short break, and then we've got two more guests waiting in the wings talking about what else the president talked about and the state of our politics. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Biden was in familiar territory last night when he addressed a joint session of Congress, having spent decades in the U.S. Senate. He inherited a nation facing multiple crises, the pandemic, the economy, a racial reckoning, and deep polarization. His focus is on strengthening the middle and working class with good-paying jobs, expanded free education, paid family leave, tax credits paid for by taxing the rich and corporations, many of which pay no taxes. He called for police reform, protecting the right to vote, tackling climate change, cutting drug prices, and touted progress made on the coronavirus vaccine rollout. But he does face a deeply divided country and a Republican Party mostly not willing to cross the partisan aisle. Here to talk about all of this is Amanda Turkle. She is Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda Turkle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Mark Nevins. He's a partner at the Dover Group. That's a political communications firm. He's also a Democratic strategist joining us by Skype. And Mark Nevins, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Good to be here.
Good to have you both with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. We want to hear from you. If you watched the president or listened to the president last night, or you just if you have opinions about what he is or isn't doing, what the Republican Party is or isn't doing, we want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Mark, I mentioned to our first guest that he seems like a president in a great big hurry. What is making the Biden administration just fast track everything so quickly?
Well, you know, on a political level, you know, the midterm elections in 2022 have the potential to be unkind to the president and to the Democrats. You know, traditionally, the party that controls the White House loses seats in the first midterm election, and the Democrats have thin majorities in both the House and the Senate. So moving quickly, I think, is a political priority just on a practical level. But also, I think the way the president laid it out last night in his speech was to frame it as a global race against not only time, but also the ambition of autocrats, as he called them, you know, China, Russia, and others who have their vision set on, you know, being the global superpowers of the next 100 years. And if we want to compete with that, we don't have any time to waste.
Well, Amanda, a variation on that same question, and I was talking with our first guest about it, and it's very obvious. President Biden believes in big government. He believes in spending trillions of dollars to address some of these short-term crises that we have and some of these long-term problems looking into the future. Does that surprise you as someone who has probably covered Senator or even Vice President Biden to see such a progressive in the White House?
A little bit. I think a lot of progressives were skeptical of him because he has a more moderate reputation. He has taken some positions over the years that progressives don't particularly like. But I think Biden recognized that he's a president for a certain moment. You know, he needs a unified Democratic Party. He thinks that this is the time when there's a lot of agreement amongst the country on what people want. You know, they want the coronavirus to be over. They want government to start working. And I think he sees his job, honestly, as a lot of restoring faith in government and democracy. You know, you hear Biden speak about FDR quite a bit. Yeah. And, you know, he's trying to do more through these, you know, the American Families Plan, through the rescue plan and through his jobs plan and everything he's trying to do. It's more than just a bailout or a stimulus, what we've heard other presidents do that, you know, also cost a lot of money. You know, he is, you know, he is saying, you know, we need to do a lot more to address the problems of the structures of democracy to make sure that democracy still works, that people still believe in it. This isn't something where we just throw a little bit of money at the problem and, you know, the banks will get better or something like that. You know, this is that there are things that are broken. There are roads, there are bridges, the childcare system, the education system. And he's trying to address those root causes more, which is pretty, you know, which is so much more than we saw, you know, say even President Obama do.
Well, and Amanda, he's saying there are problems and government is here to help you.
Exactly. I mean,
it better work. I mean, he's really putting government on the line to say that government can be a force for good in this country.
He wants people to see, like you said, government as a force for good. He wants people to see government in their lives, whether that is, you know, getting the vaccine shots in your arms, whether that is getting, you know, checks in your pocket. He wants people to be aware of what government can do and that it can be a force for good.
Mark, let me go back to you. And I do want to talk, sort of get beyond a psychological profile, but I want to toss it to you anyway. And I was thinking about Biden And I saw a quote from Michelle Cottle, who said that he has made the presidency boring again. And she saw that as a real accomplishment. But I was thinking about Trump and also Obama, who people either loved or love or hated or hate. And there's something about Biden that he sort of slips in the middle there. As a strategist, what do you see?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think Republicans right now are going to find themselves in a difficult situation because the president is not someone who's easily demonized or turned into a political boogeyman, if you will. He's somebody that has proposed some big ideas and comes across as thoughtful and willing to work across the aisle, but not willing to sacrifice his agenda for it. I'm not sure he's presented them with the same kind of opportunities to run against as perhaps President Obama did, which probably was driven as much by race as it was by ideology, or even, you know, certainly Hillary Clinton or President Clinton. And so you see them turning to people like Nancy Pelosi or AOC as their scare tactics in campaign scenarios. So, you know, in that sense, the president is making it far more difficult politically for Republicans to create something to fear. Having said that, I think what Amanda said was really interesting in that we're at this very unique time in history that perhaps we're not appreciating just yet because it's so fresh. But after, you know, 4 years of kind of meandering incompetence from the Trump administration and this last going on more than a year now of a global pandemic that fundamentally altered the way we look at how our country operates, this president is creating an agenda that makes people feel like there is some focus and some direction in which we can go so that we all feel a lot better about what's happening in this country. And, you know, he's created an agenda that perhaps puts him at the front of that train rather than at the back of it.
Yeah, and it'll be very interesting to see sort of where everything ends up. Amanda, there's a question from Dave I want to put to you. He says, and this is about the $400,000 per person or per family. This is the tax that the president wants to impose on people who are wealthy, making $400,000 or more to help pay for all these programs. He wants to know, is that per person, per family? Do you have an answer to that?
I don't know the details of that note, so I'm sorry, I don't have the details on that. But can I talk more about just sort of the idea behind this? Because the president
sure.
is already getting
sure.
So he's already getting attacked by quite a few Republicans and actually just wealthy people who are sort of freaking out about a lot of the taxes and a lot about what Biden is doing. But what you see the White House doing is really leaning into, you know, this idea of, you know, taxing the wealthy, going after corporations. This is popular with the American public. And you had Anita Dunn, who's a senior White House advisor, saying that this is, you know, this is something the White House should lean into. We should not be afraid to take on corporations, to take on the wealthy. And I think, you know, some of this is lessons they've learned from the Obama years. But I think also shows how the party has shifted over the years, has become a little bit more progressive. And, you know, maybe this is some of the progressive Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders influence sort of rubbing off a little. But, you know, I think Biden also had a little bit more of a populist streak than people maybe gave him credit for or recognized, you know, sort of within his moderate persona. And so the White House, you're going to see them really leaning into this. And I don't think you're going to see them backing away from it very much.
To Dave, and only just because I was just doing some quick prep for today's show, according to Axios, they said is $400,000 per person. So it would be nearly twice that, or about twice that per family. That's my understanding. Again, quoting from Axios. Let me just reintroduce our guest. And I do want to play another clip from last night. Amanda Turkle is Washington Bureau Chief for Huffington Post. Mark Nevins is a partner at the Dover Group, and that's a political communications firm. And we are talking about President Biden's speech to a sparsely attended joint session of Congress last night, not because people didn't want to be there, but because of the COVID regulations. And we want to hear from you, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Well, picking up on this progressive bent that the president has, here's another clip from last night, and he's talking about his support for the PRO Act and the $15 minimum wage. This was at last night's address to Congress.
Good guys and women on Wall Street, but Wall Street didn't build this country. The middle class built the country, and unions built the middle class. So that's why I'm calling on Congress to pass Protect the Right to Organize Act, the PRO Act, and send it to my desk so we can support the right to unionize. And by the way, while you're thinking about sending things to my desk, let's raise the minimum wage to $15.
Mark, I mean, that, you know, you've got a president touting unions. You don't hear that every day.
No, certainly not. Although I suspect that it's a reaction to some of the subtle or even not so subtle anti-union efforts that have been going on around the country, whether it's, you know, right to work legislation or sort of anti-union sentiments being expressed by bigger corporations. You know, I think the president is saying to working people that this is not just about, you know, this is about them as much as it is about anything else. And I think one of the themes that he repeated throughout his remarks was jobs, a focus on jobs, that when more people are working, you know, our economy grows, the middle class grows. And one way to make sure that we are protecting jobs and creating jobs is to strengthen, you know, the right for people to organize and to make sure that people working in minimum wage jobs are earning a livable wage.
Amanda, here's a question from Ruthie. She says, if the American people support these plans and priorities, why aren't Republican lawmakers behind them? Aren't they worried about re-election? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think, you know, that this is the argument that Biden is making when he's pressed on why he's not being more bipartisan. And, you know, when every Republican in Congress is opposing what he's doing, and he's saying, you know, just because Republicans in Congress are opposing what I'm doing doesn't mean I don't have bipartisan support. You know, plenty of Republicans out there support what I'm doing. And that's his definition of bipartisanship. So, you know, I think the caller, you know, has the listener has a great question of why aren't Republicans going along with what their constituents want. And so they are, you know, I think you have some who are a little bit more, you know, in more swing areas or swing districts who are more persuadable. But a lot of them aren't. And they are focusing on their base. And they think that if they just get enough, you know, these Trump supporting diehard conservatives who don't like anything about what Biden and Democrats are doing, that's all they need to get reelected. You know, there may be some more independent folks who do like what Biden's doing, but they figure that they don't need them. And if they cross this other, you know, more far right faction, they will be in jeopardy of losing their seats. And so for many of them, that's the calculation they're making right now. And, you know, they don't want Trump weighing in either and speaking out against what they're doing.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting, Amanda, how Trump still haunts the Republican Party.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, right now, he is still the leader of the Republican Party, even though he's the former president. You know, there's the question of, is he going to run again? He could. He could run again in 2024. But, you know, right now, Republicans are still petrified of him. He still commands a very, very loyal base. And you're seeing more candidates come up who are in his model. And so you see people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, Madison Cawthorn. You know, these are freshman members in the House, incredibly conservative, you know, have sort of fueled and helped fan the flames of conspiracy theories. And, you know, they probably wouldn't be around without Donald Trump and the example he set and sort of the base he ignited. And so, you know, folks like this, just like once the Tea Party was considered very fringe and it became a little bit more mainstream, I think we're going to see more candidates and more lawmakers like this.
Mark, do you think the Democrats fear Trump, a return of Trump?
No, I think they long for it.
Oh, they long for it. They want it. Okay, why is that?
He is a convenient foil. I don't think anybody's ever been as effective as a fundraising tool for Democrats as President Trump. And in a lot of the swingier districts in, you know, places like here in the sort of Philadelphia suburban districts, in any sort of big city, suburban area, you know, Trump is anathema. He is a problem for moderate Republicans running for re-election. And so as much as he helps Republicans in conservative areas, he is a problem for moderate Republicans running in toss-up or even Democratic-leaning districts. So I don't think Democrats fear Trump. I think he's a convenient opponent against whom they can run, and it's sort of the flip side to the, you know, Joe Biden coin we were just talking about, which is that, you know, you need someone to run against as much as you need to be for something. It's also helpful to be against something, and there are stakes in the election that if you vote the wrong way, there is a consequence. And you know, for Democrats, the consequence has been Donald Trump. And, you know, I think having him back in the ballgame only helps.
Well, we're going to take another short break and get back to our conversation. That's Mark Nevins, also with us, Amanda Turkle. We're talking about President Biden's speech last night to a joint session of Congress, the first now 100 days of his administration. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. President Biden addressed a joint session of Congress last night, now 100 days into his term. We've been talking about what he and his administration have accomplished so far. How closely has he kept his campaign promises? We should talk about that, and also what policy priorities remain. And again, our guests are Amanda Turkle. She's Washington Bureau Chief for Huffington Post, and Mark Nevins. He's a partner at the Dover Group, which is a political communications firm. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Amanda, I want to go back and just I was looking at President Biden's cabinet, apparently the most diverse ever. 50% of the cabinet is non-white and 46% of the cabinet is women. We saw last night the president standing in front of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Vice President Kamala Harris, and that has never happened before. I wonder if you could just speak to some pretty dramatic, at least visual changes in our federal government.
So, you know, Biden, when he ran, he was running in an incredibly diverse Democratic primary field. you know, there were women, there were people of color. And then there was Biden, who, you know, is about, you know, he's as Washington as you can get. He had been in the Senate for decades, vice president, you know, he's a Washington institutional guy. He is obviously also an older white man. And so Biden recognized that if he were to become president, you know, or even honestly the Democratic nominee, he needed to appeal to this changing face of his party and of the country. And so he committed early on to choosing a female vice president. He was under a lot of pressure to have that person be Black, especially after Black voters really propelled him to his win in South Carolina. He has promised to appoint a Black woman or nominate a Black woman to the Supreme Court. His judicial nominees have been incredibly diverse. And so this is something that Biden has committed to in making sure that, you know, people who traditionally don't hold power in the political structures get a chance to in his administration. And so, yeah, this is something that he has said he's been committed to. And again, I think he was cognizant of the fact that he doesn't look like a lot of the younger voters and the newer voters in the party.
Clear. Mark, let me go back to you. And then we've got lots more comments here, but I just wanted to put out immigration and, you know, other presidents before Biden has struggled with what to do about people coming to the U.S. border, U.S.-Mexico border. I won't even go through all the history because I think we know it. But at the same time, I mean, clearly the Biden administration was unprepared to handle the numbers of children who've been arriving at that border, what to do with them to make sure that they are taken care of or found, you know, families that they can live with. There are questions about refugee admissions. It seems like they should have anticipated that this was going to be such a critical and controversial issue. And then it seems like they were not ready for it.
Well, I think, first of all, I think they deserve credit for at least changing the approach or acknowledging that you can have a strong border while still treating people coming to the border as human beings with dignity. Those things are not mutually exclusive. I do think that situations globally are creating an environment where the risk of coming to the United States is smaller than the risk of staying in their home country. Right. And I think we have to accept that this is still, for all of the faults that we easily find in our own country, that it's still a model for the rest of the world and that people want to be here. And perhaps our objective should not be to figure out how to get them to stop coming, but rather figure out how to create a path for them to come to our country and become a part of our country, become a part of our social network, acclimate to our culture and become American citizens, because it's how we were built. And certainly, you know, sending them back to a place where they are either living in abject poverty or become part of, you know, a, you know, oppositional component of another country is unhelpful. I think we've seen that that doesn't work.
And he has tasked Vice President Harris to, in a sense, have his old job, which is trying to deal with some of the issues that drive people from their homes and from their countries to that border. Let me read a couple of comments, and I do want to play another clip. Warren says, I'm 100% behind the Biden plan since most of the revenue of government comes from personal income tax. Increasing jobs and income is the best way to generate the necessary income to do the work of government. And he goes on from there. Ray says, why is Biden trying to slip in all kinds of unrelated issues into these huge funding plans, like in his infrastructure plan, instead of focusing just on real infrastructure that could get passed in Congress? Man, if I could toss that to you, he does throw in broadband and some other issues that he has perhaps redefined as what infrastructure is. Is there a short answer to that comment from our listener?
Yeah, I think he's gotten a lot of criticism for this from Republicans, and they're citing it as part of the reason they're not going to support it. And, you know, he's saying that things like broadband are infrastructure. You need that to sort of go about your basic functioning. If you don't have broadband, if internet, things like that, you know, things like childcare, they are saying that this is human infrastructure and we need to expand the way we think about the system beyond just traditional roads and bridges.
Let me play another clip from last night, and this is President Biden discussing the terrorist threat facing the United States, including Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and he added white supremacists. Let's give it a listen.
And we won't ignore what our intelligence agencies have determined to be the most lethal terrorist threat to the homeland today. White supremacy is terrorism. We're not going to ignore that either.
We're not going to ignore that either. To you, Amanda, that was a pretty bold statement coming from the president. How was that received?
You know, I think that he's in, you know, he's in a solid place saying this after what we saw on January 6th. And he was standing, you know, where, you know, in the place that was stormed by these Trump supporters. Who, you know, many of them have sort of espoused views along these lines. And, you know, Trump obviously also was always fanning the flames and sort of pushing these racist dog whistles and sort of courting white supremacists into his orbit. And so, you know, this is what Biden said is right. This is a real issue. And a lot of times presidents have been a little bit afraid to go after it too harshly because they don't want to alienate people. And Biden's saying right out that this is a problem. This is a growing problem. It has been growing. It was a backlash to President Obama. You know, again, Trump ignited this a bit more, and this is continuing. And so, you know, I think that after January 6th, the full display of the problem was there. But, you know, we're seeing this more and more in incidents that are happening when you hear about mass shooters. Some of them have espoused views like this. And so, you know, I think that Biden will get, you know, quite a bit of support for what he's doing.
What do you think, Mark, as a political strategist yourself?
Yes, I think as a political strategy, it's advisable to be against white supremacy. There should really be no middle ground on white supremacy or white supremacists. I think, you know, President Trump caused us to, you know, for worse, I think, reconsider the notion of what was fair and should we give these guys, you know, the benefit of the doubt, or some of his rhetoric about, you know, bad people on both sides. It was ridiculous. And I think what we're seeing is just the President Biden reminding us that there is a black and white, no pun intended, there is a binary situation here. You are either against white supremacy or you're for it. There's no middle ground on this issue.
Let me read some more comments, and I want to play one more clip from last night. Ed says, I don't understand why Trump voters aren't for all the provisions in Biden's plan. He had a lot of working class folks, an increase in the minimum wage, free college. These are things that should be very appealing. A comment from Rick, with all the federal aid going to folks now. Is that the same thing? Oh, no. Going to folks, they both use the word folks. And now that it's all being extended, employers are having trouble finding workers because they're getting income. And this is coming just as the economy is coming back. And there is an argument, Amanda, that, you know, with all this money coming from the government, is that preventing people from going back to work? Because if you, for instance, not making $15 an hour, you're making a minimum wage, you might be better off, at least financially, getting money from the government.
So this is an argument that pops up whenever the government proposes giving people assistance, that if you give people help, they won't want to work. And that hasn't been borne out. You know, Republicans have always used this to argue against social safety net programs. You know, people want to work. You don't, you know, you work, yes, for a paycheck, but you work for other reasons too, for your livelihood, for, you know, a sense of self-confidence. You know, getting this, if you say, you know, have a minimum wage job, you're also getting money from the government. That is not making you so wealthy that you want to simply sit around and you say, I don't need it to do anymore. You know, this money, especially, you know, we heard, honestly, a lot of these arguments during the pandemic. The reason people were not going back to work wasn't because they were getting government assistance. It's because they were afraid of dying because of the pandemic, and they didn't want to go back to their jobs. And so, you know, they had a choice sometimes of their employers trying to force them back or, you know, trying to stay home, but they needed some help. And so, you know, we are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel of the pandemic, but we're not out of it yet. And the destruction that the pandemic has wrought economically, not only overall, but for individuals, you know, that is going to take a long time to come out of. And so, you know, just because you're going to be getting some government assistance, there's, you know, you have rent to pay off, you have all these other debts, you have student loan. And so I think that's a lot of what this is trying to address.
Let me play one more clip, and this is President Biden talking about the George Floyd murder and the fight for racial justice from last night's speech to Congress.
It was nearly a year ago before her father's funeral when I spoke with Gianna Floyd, George Floyd's young daughter. She's a little tyke, so I was kneeling down to talk to her so I could look her in the eye. She looked at me, she said, "My daddy changed the world." Well, after the conviction of George Floyd's murderer, we can see how right she was if we have the courage to act as a Congress. We've all seen the knee of injustice on the neck of Black Americans. Now's our opportunity to make some real progress.
Mark, I mean, since the now murder of George Floyd, we are in this moment of racial reckoning. Do you think the country as a whole is up to the task?
I would like to believe that the country is up to the task. However, I have been disappointed on that front, and I think a lot of us have been disappointed on that front over the years, and our ability to want to believe that all is well when it's not is sometimes our greatest hurdle. So I do think that at the local level, you're seeing things change in a lot of places. You know, whether it's at a sort of county level, district attorney agenda, or even states and municipalities making changes, but at a national level, I think it's a challenge because I do think that there are far too many people in positions of elected power who refuse to acknowledge the scope of the problem.
Amanda Turkel, the Republicans had Senator Rick Scott give the response to Biden's address. He is
Tim Scott.
Tim Scott. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Tim Scott from South Carolina. Do I have that? South Carolina?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Nothing like being corrected on the air, but I appreciate that. What did you make of his selection to do that and what he said? He said, "We are not a racist country."
I mean, his choice was, you know, the choice of Tim Scott was very strategic. He is working on, you know, the criminal justice reforms. He is the only Black Republican senator. And he has, you know, he is very conservative, but he has a very different, you know, if you look at his voting record, it was, you know, it was fairly in line with what the Trump administration's agenda was. But he has a very different way of presenting himself. He is, you know, he's a very nice guy. He's very friendly. He tries to use language that is a little more conciliatory and tries to bring people together than you saw Trump or some other Republicans do. But, you know, he still went after Biden. You know, it was not a conciliatory speech, though, I would say. No. It went after Biden's proposals, saying that they were radical, you know, essentially socialism, and, you know, going after Democrats. And so, you know, Tim Scott is a Republican, but I think I think in a lot of ways he puts on a much nicer face for the Republican Party and makes it seem like a more welcoming, bigger tent because of, you know, sort of his friendly demeanor.
Well, we have to leave it there. And my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Amanda Turkel, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She is Washington Bureau Chief for Huffington Post. Mark Nevins, thanks to you for coming back on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's a partner at the Dover Group, which is a political communications firm. And he is a Democratic strategist. And we began with Megan Casella, a reporter for Politico. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.